Yale University School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. And the way we learned about her is she actually, in the last, I guess it was the last couple of years, co-authored a report looking at price versus non-price water conservation strategies, and looked at some comparison between those two, you know, costs, benefits, the economics behind that. And it's a really exciting report, and we're really excited that she was able to join us today. So let's go ahead and welcome her.
Okay, so thanks very much, Laura. It's always a pleasure to come to Austin. What Laura didn't mention, actually, is that my parents moved here in 1993, and I'm a graduate of the master's program at the LBJ School of Public Affairs. So that said, I know... Okay, so what Laura didn't mention is I actually have some roots in Texas, even though I'm sort of down here from the cold and rainy New England spring. I'm a graduate of the Master's in Public Affairs program at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas. So I sort of have been in and around Austin on and off since 1993. And that said, I actually know probably less than anyone in this room about water conservation in Texas. So you might be asking yourself, why am I on the program? And as Laura mentioned, I'm basically a water resource economist. And I've done a lot of work on the role of pricing in water conservation and thinking as carefully as I can about how prices affect consumers' behavior, especially in urban settings. And so today I'm going to give kind of a very general overview of what the role of water pricing is in water conservation, touch a little bit on some specific things that I've been able to sort of pick up relevant for Texas, and then hopefully that'll contribute to the sort of larger conversation today about conservation in Texas specifically. Okay, so the first thing I did when Laura asked me to come down was to sort of think about, can I educate myself a little bit about what's going on in Texas, sort of positives and negatives on water conservation. And so I went to the Texas Water Matters website, and I looked at some of the different sort of editorials, op-eds, and sort of headlines that had come up in recent years that were cited on the website. And one was from the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, regional message, clear, conserve. Okay, this pattern is going to be very similar. This is a national publication, the Christian Science Monitor. Thirsty lawn owners, beware the water cops, okay, from 2007. The San Antonio Express News, proposed drought restrictions on the aquifer are harsher. And then a publication, Texarkana Gazette, treat water as money because it is. So this is getting a little closer to the way an economist would think about water and water pricing. And then the closest one is an op-ed written by a colleague of mine in the New York Times during a sort of unusual and pretty severe drought in New England in the summer of 1999, and he says, how to stop water, squandering water, raise its price. And that's sort of the theme of what I'm talking about today. And it's interesting, again, sort of being from New England, what we often think of as our scarcest resource, especially in the winter, is heating oil. Okay, we get very concerned about, you know, do low-income families have enough money to heat their homes and so on. And we don't often see, I mean, in the winter, there are lots of headlines about the cost of heating your home. But we don't often see, and in my memory, certainly haven't seen, any occasion on which a governor or, you know, a mayor sort of comes on TV and says, you know, the temperatures are really cold, heating oil is a scarce and valuable resource, so everyone please set your thermostat at 65 degrees, and that will be enforced, right? Everybody has to sort of do exactly the same thing. And we don't sort of do it that way. Well, why don't we do it that way? Well, there's a sort of free market for heating oil. What happens when the resource is scarce? The price goes up, and so the value of the resource is reflected in the price. That's an important signal to homeowners. They may turn down their thermostats. They may put on a sweater. They may do whatever they want to do. But in general, aside from the very important point of worrying about low-income consumers and what they do during times like this, we pay more for the valuable resource in the winter than we certainly when we do other times of year. And we pay more in years in which the resource is scarce for other reasons aside from temperature, like a year like this year, than we would in other years. And no economist really would recommend, you know, sort of an unfettered free market for water. We'll talk about a couple of reasons in a few minutes about why that's the case. It's a very special kind of commodity and some sort of has important physical and economic properties and social properties that would, you know, sort of require us to treat it differently as we do. But in general, right, other sort of scarce resources like the oil resource that I just mentioned are allocated by markets. In markets, prices transmit some very important information to individual users of the resource about how valuable it is. And as a result, we see sort of, you know, resources allocated across sectors like industrial, commercial, residential, agricultural sectors in ways that approach at least what we would think of as sort of an efficient distribution across sectors. Again, as I mentioned, this is sort of the kind of markets that we have for oil are undesirable for a lot of reasons if we think about moving them into the water sector. And why is that the case? Well, you think about water and its sort of special physical properties. It's very mobile. It sort of seeps, it evaporates, it moves around. It's very hard to establish sort of tradable property rights to this resource, except for, of course, groundwater is a good example in which that is still true, but a little bit less true. So we do see some sort of establishment of markets for water, for surface water and groundwater, but less so than we see for many other types of resources and commodities. It's also very bulky, so think about, you know, sort of very heavy per for unit of volume or unit of value. And so we don't see, you know, sort of very large-scale pipeline systems and trucking systems for water the way that we do for oil or natural gas, other commodities that are, you know, sort of pure natural resources in the sense that water is as well, but are more valuable per unit weight, essentially. So it sort of makes sense, makes economic sense to transport them in many places long distances in order to bring them to markets where people are willing to pay for them. There are also lots of economies of scale in water production, and that's true for producing piped drinking water, as a variety of other uses as well. And what that means, essentially, there's huge upfront fixed cost to distributing water, and so the average cost declines over almost any quantity you can imagine producing, and it makes sense in most cases to have one supplier serving, you know, sort of a given region. And so for that reason, we think about sort of a regulated monopoly rather than having lots of different sort of competitive corporations sort of dealing in water the way we would see with heating oil, again, for example, in the Northeast in the wintertime. And that sort of makes it a special type of commodity as well. Importantly, on the water quality side, it has solvent properties. It can assimilate some wastes, at least in many water systems. And so as a result, people dump wastes into water resources. And so we have to think about externalities, and we have to think about the fact that they're sort of serving many different purposes aside from simply being drinking water. There's a lot of variability in supply, and that can be mitigated through reservoirs and other things that we do in many places. But in general, again, that's sort of a little bit different from you know, sort of soccer balls or widgets or anything that you could sort of produce more of as long as you have greater capacity to do so. It's sequential in use, so lots of users on the same system, so we have to worry about that. There are many complementary uses. A drinking water reservoir might also be used for recreation or many other purposes. And then, of course, importantly, there are a lot of sort of social and cultural values that suggest that people really sort of feel as though they have, you know, there's at least a very basic agreement that for water for drinking, bathing, cooking, and so on is a basic need. People have a right to access to that, at least a limited quantity of water at very low prices. And then that sort of spreads onward, right? Our sense of entitlement to water sort of depends on where we live and at what point in time we live. But in general, many people sort of feel entitled to it as a public service, even in quantities well above what we would think of as sort of subsistence quantities. And that makes it, again, different from heating oil and other things that are, again, pure natural resources that happen to be managed through markets. Okay, so what happens as a result of the fact that it has all these very special properties? There's lots of intervention by governments, local, regional, state, national governments in water resource management. Right, we have lots of regulations. Those are for water pollution control. The actual legal apportionment of property rights is done by governments. Water pricing, if it's not done directly by governments, it's often regulated by governments. And I'll be talking mostly about that aspect today. Public sector invests in infrastructure, so it develops, as we say, water supplies. It worries about flood control, navigation, hydropower, irrigation, right, many other types of infrastructure projects that are supported by the public sector. And then finally, it often owns and operates the actual sort of treatment and distribution systems for piped water in municipal settings, and it may also own and operate recreational areas that are water-based as well. Okay. So again, today my function is mostly to talk about water pricing and what the role of that is in conservation. And I have two quotes here. They're 200 plus years apart. Okay, so Adam Smith, famous guy who wrote in The Wealth of Nations in 1776, "Nothing is more useful than water, but it will purchase scarce anything. Scarce anything can be had in exchange for it." And at the time, Smith was pointing out the sort of important, what was called the water diamond paradox. How could something that's so valuable might be so cheap, and then you take something like diamonds that are so, well, sort of valuable to some people, but not necessarily to sustain human life, and those are so expensive. And he was pointing out this important contradiction that really the value of something has to do both with its scarcity, right, i.e. diamonds are very scarce, and water at the time in England in 1776 wasn't particularly scarce, or at least perceived as particularly scarce, and its value in use, water having a very high value in use, diamonds low value in use, right? But that sort of the combination of those two things is what establishes the price of something. And he could explain that. Okay, didn't once he went through his explanation, it didn't seem so irrational. But again, right, he's sort of writing in 1776, it's rainy England, you know, relatively small population, even to what England is compared today. And 200 years later, my colleague Robert Stevens, who's at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, writes in the New York Times in that op-ed that I cited earlier, I can still refill an 8-ounce glass of soda about 2,500 times for less than the cost of a can of soda, right? Fill it with water for less than the cost of a can of soda. And so really there's not much that has changed. And unfortunately, the sort of underlying premise of Smith's explanation as to why water is so cheap way back when doesn't really hold so well today, right? Because it is a scarce resource, it is a valuable resource, and we still haven't sort of come into the period where we recognize that in the pricing structures, okay? So we don't have a market that sets the price. In large part, we have sort of governments or quasi-public entities that set prices, and we're still not doing a great job of really recognizing sort of what the value of the resource happens to be. Okay, so what can we think of if we want to imagine how we might use prices affect demand? Usually what we're thinking about is increasing prices and affecting some kind of reduction in demand, okay, in consumption. And the concept that economists would use to measure that is something called price elasticity, and many of you are familiar with this. What it basically means is what is the percentage decrease in demand that I can expect from a 1% or 10% increase in price. And on average, if we look at this sort of across studies, there are probably now 300 plus published estimates of water price elasticity in various markets and various sectors in the United States and many other parts of the world since 1960. So economists have been pretty prolific in coming up with these estimates. And if we were to summarize them, I would say, you know, we could, you know, essentially look on average that a 10% increase in price in the marginal price of water, so that price you pay for the last 1,000 gallons, is going to affect demand by about a 3 to 4% reduction, okay, in U.S. cities. That's in urban settings, so not agricultural settings. And that's in the short run. We might imagine it's actually much bigger. The average in the long run's closer to about a 6 to 7% decrease from a 10% price increase in the long run. Because in the long run, people can do a lot of the things that Marianne was talking about earlier. They can switch out their clothes washers, right, or switch out their landscaping, which is something that Amy was talking about a couple of minutes ago. So those are kind of important numbers. It gives people sort of a general sense for how much price can affect demand. But of course, that's going to vary from place to place and from time to time. So the most important thing, if you're sort of running a municipal water department or another water entity, is what is the exact number for my city or my town or my mud or whatever in this particular year? And it's very hard to sort of understand and extrapolate from these sort of means of academic studies out there what exactly that's going to be. It's not as predictable as we would like it to be. But in general, we want to think about what are the things that might affect that sensitivity to price. That's a really important sort of set of things as well. One thing on the whole that affects that is the level of prices. Okay, so on average, under higher prices, we think consumers are more price sensitive than they are under lower prices, because there's some pretty intuitive reasons why that varies over space and over time. Okay, so there are lots of things that we could add to that list. But if we wanted to compare these kinds of price approaches, the approach of raising prices to affect water conservation, to non-price policies, we could do it on a variety of bases or a variety of dimensions. And the first thing that we're going to talk about in a couple minutes is cost effectiveness, because that's come up a couple of times. But if I were to summarize, again, many, many people in this room know much more than I do about the effectiveness of non-price conservation policy, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about individual studies and so on, because you all have much more experience with that than I do. But if we kind of look across the studies that have been published on effectiveness, we can sort of see the variation that Amy was mentioning earlier, solely for this, you know, one study in Texas. We can see that variation across the country in types of programs that are implemented and in the effectiveness of those types of programs. And to summarize, I would say that it's sort of very intuitive, right? Those more stringent, the mandatory policies, when they're well enforced, tend to have sort of stronger effects, stronger reductions in demand that we can measure and attribute to those policies than do the voluntary policies or the education programs alone. And another thing to kind of keep in mind is something that often turns up in these studies is that the water savings from the policies that are trying to promote water conservation, things like changing out fixtures and so on, may actually be smaller than you would expect given the sort of manufacturer specification, right, for those particular types of fixtures and appliances due to people's behavioral responses to those appliances and fixtures. Now, things have gotten much better over time. We've gotten much better at introducing technologies for these kinds of programs that people genuinely like, and, you know, better low-flush toilets, better low-flow showerheads, and so on. But there are plenty of studies out there showing that when you implement these things, for example, there's a study by Lucas Davis, who's an economist at Michigan, shows that when you sort of wholesale replace the top-loading clothes washers with front-loading clothes washers, well, the cost of each load of laundry has just gone down because you're using less energy, you're using less water per load. And so people do, on average, about 6 or 7% more sort of laundry washing or clothes washing than they were doing with their old top-loading clothes washer because the price has decreased, right? So you want to think about what are those kinds of behavioral responses that you might expect with these technological interventions, and think about trying to make sure you build that in to an understanding of what the programs are actually going to do when they're implemented. Okay, so if we were to compare the price approach and the non-price approach, again, we're going to sort of do that in a variety of different dimensions. And the first dimension is going to be this question of cost effectiveness. And essentially, there's tons of sort of economic theory and papers and all this on this question in pollution control. Okay, water pollution control, air pollution control. Is it better to use what economists would call kind of the traditional approaches or command and control approaches? Is it better to use market-based approaches like taxes and tradable permits and so on? Lots and lots of papers on this, and lots of evidence on the pollution control side that it is more cost-effective to reduce pollution with the price-based approaches than it is to do that with the more sort of traditional or prescriptive approaches. Now, this is sort of, we're sort of new, myself and others are new in bringing this type of analysis to the question of sort of resource use and water use in particular. But there is certainly a theoretical basis for believing that it's more cost-effective to reduce consumption through price increases than it would be through using the non-price programs, like technology standards and so on. And there's some recent empirical work that supports that. So the first paper I would say that really supported that was a work by Chris Timmons, an economist who worked in California, and published a paper in 2003 showing that basically while there is a lot of water savings attributable to low-flow toilets, for example, that you can actually do that, achieve the same level of water savings more cost-effectively or more cheaply by implementing a water tax or a water price increase. And then I have a recent study with a colleague of mine at the School of Management at Yale who's actually an energy economist, where we look across 12 or 13 different cities in the US and Canada, and we simulate replacing what would happen with a two-day-per-week outdoor watering restriction, and we replace that instead with drought pricing and letting the price reflect the scarcity of the resource. And we can show that both policies can achieve the same level of water savings, but when we do it with the price increases rather than the two-day-per-week outdoor watering restrictions, we achieve a cost savings of about $81 per household per summer drought. Here's a substantial for a very large city. Again, this is going to differ, right, depending on the size of the city and aridity and many other factors. So the cost effectiveness question is one that's an important one to kind of keep in mind if we're deciding, okay, which type of program should we use, right, or should we use both? And sort of we want you to keep in mind that prices are, you know, a pretty good, look pretty good on this dimension. Okay, so what about the impact on utility net revenue? This is something that Marianne mentioned earlier, and it's always something that as an economist I sort of look at and I'm surprised that is not discussed more frequently. So those estimates that I gave you earlier for the effects on demand of price increases, that 3-4% reduction for a 10% increase in prices, that is in what economists would call the inelastic range, okay, meaning that for a 1% increase in prices results in a smaller than 1% decrease in demand. And what that means, it's an esoteric fact in some ways, right? But for someone who's interested in utility revenues, it's a very, very highly relevant fact, because what that means is at current estimates of elasticity, almost anywhere in the world that you can do it or find the studies that have been done, when you raise prices, revenues are going to go up, okay, because demand goes down, but not enough to basically reduce total revenues. Okay, so that's a really kind of important thing to keep in mind. And if we look at ways that cities have approached water conservation, there have been some very high-profile cases in Los Angeles and other cities that I know of quite well, where the city had to achieve a water conservation goal. They implemented some very successful mandatory and voluntary restrictions. Consumers succeeded in the sense that they actually went ahead, that they conserved 15 or 20% water of total water demand in the city. And then as a result, revenues go down, and you've also spent money on the conservation programs. And so then the city then has to come back and say, you know, we need a rate increase, right, because our revenues are down and we've also spent money on the conservation program. Whereas if you sort of think, again, you know, this is political feasibility aside, and I'll come to that question in a couple of minutes, if they had simply raised the price and achieved the same level of water savings to begin with, they wouldn't then be in the position going back to consumers and saying, right, thanks, you succeeded in saving water, now I hope you don't mind, but we're going to go ahead and increase the price. So we find that to be kind of an interesting aspect of the comparison to the two types of programs. Okay, then there's also always a question of monitoring and enforcement. If you're comparing different policy approaches to achieving water conservation, you might be concerned about which ones are sort of more easily enforceable, more cheaply enforceable, and so on. And we have to think that this is really one of the main reasons why one of the primary tools for water conservation has been outdoor watering restrictions in the residential sector, highly observable by neighbors, by the water cops, right, or whoever it happens to be. So very relatively easy to enforce in comparison to anything you might ask people to do indoors. But if you compare the non-price policies in general to price policies, we have to think again that even on this dimension, there's some advantage to the price-based approach. Okay, non-price policies require some very significant monitoring enforcement to achieve full compliance, and maybe this is not what we're after, okay, but, you know, to full compliance is a hard thing to achieve. There's a nice study by Rand of 85 California utilities during the 1990s drought, and they summarize what it is utilities were doing and how successful those measures were. And they find that in this case, across many communities, more than half of consumers actually violated the quantity of use restrictions that were in place in these different cities. And also compliance with type of use restrictions was quite low as well in this study. Non-compliance in the context of pricing requires that consumers figure out a way to consume water off meter. Okay, now you might be concerned there are other feedback effects, right? Maybe you're in a place where it's very easy to sink a groundwater well and to get a permit for that. And so private homeowners could just switch off the piped drinking water system and do that. And that has other environmental and sort of water resource effects as well. So it's not quite as simple as that. But in general, if you're thinking about the piped water system, right, and you're wondering, you know, who's complying and who's not, it's very easy to tell that in most cases if you're talking about using price-based approaches to conservation. And what about predictability? This is something I mentioned earlier, right? To know what's going to happen in your community, right, or in your water system, if you raise the price, you kind of need to know what that price elasticity is at that point in time in that community or in that water system. And so a price elasticity estimate for a particular service area, and even maybe at a particular point in time, that's what provides a good measure, right, of the sort of expected effects of a price increase, some measure of predictability. But the same is true on the non-price program side from our perspective, right, that you really need sort of some kind of statistical evaluation of what the effectiveness of that kind of a program is in your community, or at least in a very similar community at a similar point in time, to have some degree of certainty over what it is that you're going to achieve. And in the absence of some pretty careful statistical analysis, neither policy really has a strong advantage over the other, or neither sort of class of policy has a strong advantage over the other in terms of predictability. And again, some of y'all may differ with that opinion. Another critical aspect of comparison is this question of equity and distribution. With price increases, and I can show this in my study with Aaron Manser as well, low-income households tend to contribute a greater share of aggregate water demand reductions than they would under non-price types of approaches. And so that may be a concern. You can think of that as these kinds of price increases as being sort of regressive in water consumption. But that doesn't mean at all that they need to be regressive in income. Okay? So what we're talking about if we're raising prices is in many cases increasing revenues, and in some cases very substantially given the low price elasticity estimates that we have. And so we know, right, that most utilities at most points in time, and certainly in the United States, are regulated to a particular rate of return or something that approximately equates total revenue and total cost with something built in for capital investment and other things. And so that extra money has to be, right, by law, rebated to consumers in some form, and it's very easy to think about how you might design such a program to actually either help low-income households or reward households that have been sort of particularly conservation-oriented in their historical consumption. And so long as you don't tie that rebate to your current water consumption, you will do nothing to sort of weaken that signal that the price on the margin is giving consumers. And so essentially, so almost anything is fair game with that rebate as long as it's not tied to current consumption in the current period. Okay, the impact of non-price programs on sort of this distributional equity question really depends on how the non-price programs are financed. Okay, we have to look carefully at whether these things are progressive or regressive, depending on who's saving the water, where the money for the programs is coming from, and so on. Political considerations. Okay, so I suspect a number of you are sitting here thinking, yeah, price increases, good luck, right? And so we know that raising water prices, like the elimination of any subsidy, and understanding, I think most people in this room would agree, and most economists would agree at this point in time, water is woefully underpriced relative to what the value of the resource is. So that is a subsidy, and it's a subsidy that we've all been benefiting from, but we've all been paying for it as well. And so raising those prices, removing that subsidy, can be very politically difficult. There's this sort of, not necessarily apocryphal because it's a true story, but a story about the Tucson City Council in the early 1970s, in which it was the first city to go sort of vote for marginal cost pricing, which was going to result in a very significant steep price increase for water. And the entire city council was voted out in the next election on the basis of that problem. So I'm sympathetic, right? I'm not a politically elected official, but I'm sympathetic to the argument that this is a very difficult thing in many places and many points in time to achieve. But again, we sort of have to ask this question, given that we know what we know about the need often to go back and increase prices because of successful non-price approaches, right? Because revenues go down, right? And we have to worry about what happens to the system in that case. you have to wonder whether the prevalence of non-price conservation policies demonstrates true support, right, among consumers for non-price approaches, even though they may be in many cases more costly than what we might achieve through price increases. Or perhaps a misunderstanding of the full cost of the non-price approaches, which is entirely possible. That's true of many subsidies. People aren't aware necessarily of the full cost of some of those programs. Or is it really the sort of political constraints that are faced by water suppliers and their ability to raise prices or to go to whatever sort of entity sets their prices or controls their prices and requests those price increases? So that's a really kind of interesting question. And question, in my mind about how to proceed is, how do we make this politically more palatable? And I think in some cases, we sort of rely on what Marianne was talking about earlier. People need to be educated about what the value of the resource is and start to stop feeling entitled to, sort of free resource that we certainly don't have for other valuable resources like, as I mentioned earlier, heating oil and other sort of comparisons. Okay, so then I thought I'd quickly go through some common misconceptions about water pricing that I mentioned in the study that Laura talked about a couple of minutes ago. One, you hear this really, really often. Water prices are low, so they just can't be used to reduce demand. Okay, they're so low, people are not paying attention. Well, there are 300-plus published estimates of water price elasticity out there based on 50 years of research and 50 years of low water prices. Okay, so all of these estimates that I'm summarizing and talking about today are estimated for areas at points in time in which water prices are low. That's true almost everywhere in the country, except for some of the very top tiers and some of these steeply increasing price structures. Water demand is inelastic. Again, that's a technical term that I mentioned earlier. A 1% increase in price causes less than a 1% decrease in demand. But that is not to be, and I just can't emphasize this enough, that is not to be confused with the phrase unresponsive to price. Okay? It is most certainly established that it is responsive to price. And lucky for utility revenues, in many cases, it is responsive, but not so much so that an increase in price actually reduces revenues. Okay? So that's a really important point, and I can't emphasize it enough. Another very common misconception is that water customers are unaware of prices, and thus the price can't be used to reduce demand. Okay, the first answer to that question is that, again, we've looked out there, we've 50 years of study, very, very few studies in literature say that nobody is responding to water prices. So customers at least act as if they're conscious of the water price and reacting to the idea that the more they use, the more they pay. That is true. So now some people say, well, yeah, but they don't receive the bill very often. It's not like when you go to the grocery store and you buy a can of tuna and you see the price and then you make a choice, right? You're not standing in the shower and watching the meter the way you do at the gasoline pump. But again, those studies that I'm sort of summarizing in this talk today, those are studies of places where consumers are billed monthly, quarterly, even less frequently, sometimes twice a year, right, or even less frequently than that. So clearly it's not a complete barrier to responsiveness to price. Would it be better to get bills more often? Probably, although I will say people have tried to understand that statistically and have not shown that increased billing frequency actually reduces consumption in any meaningful way or increases price sensitivity in any meaningful way. However, what Amy mentioned earlier is that sort of educating people a little bit more about how much they use relative to the same point last year, how much they use relative to an average household in their community, what the price is. If you have a very complex pricing structure in place and it's not printed on the bill and people don't understand actually what happens when they consume more, in those cases, we can show actually statistically that giving people more information about those things does increase their sensitivity to price, does reduce their consumption. So those kinds of sort of billing education, that can actually have some effect. Another really common misconception is that increasing block pricing, this idea, right, where you have the sort of steeper marginal prices the more you consume, per se, in and of itself, provides an incentive for water conservation. Okay. Step back from that a minute. I've done tons and tons of work on increasing block pricing, on estimating demand under increasing block pricing. And what I can say is that it is high prices that provide an incentive for water conservation. And if implementing an increasing block structure increases the number of units of water that are purchased at high prices, absolutely that will affect water demand, that will reduce water demand. But controlling for the level of prices, we can show now statistically that there's no effect of implementing an increasing block price structure in and of itself on water demand. Okay? And this may have to do with the fact that Amy mentioned earlier that in many of these cases, a town might implement increasing block structures, and really none of those upper tier blocks are relevant to the average or even an above average household consumer. And in that case, of course, we wouldn't expect it to have any effect. But we can, again, sort of show that it's the prices that do this. It is not necessarily the idea that if you use more, the price is going to go up, okay? Because there's always those inframarginal prices. There are always consumers that are not going to hit the upper tiers and so on. So that's a really important point that I wanted to make. Another common misconception is, again, you know, when you're thinking about water demand and all of the things that affect it, it's a very complex problem. It's affected by weather, it's affected by season, climate, it's affected by income, importantly. And so out there, again, you often hear, you know, but and you say water prices increases are great, and here's the price elasticity, but I implemented a price increase in my town, and then the next year consumption went up, right? Again, the estimate measures that reduction in demand for a 1% price increase, all else held constant, right? We're trying to get an estimate. What's the effect just of that price, okay? And population growth, income growth, all of those other things affect demand as well. And if that stuff is going on, what your price increase did, right, is it restricted the growth in demand, but it didn't necessarily, maybe it wasn't enough to actually reduce demand. Okay, so that's a really important distinction, right? The price increase, if it's followed by an increase in demand, those other factors are at work, okay? It's not that the price increase drove demand up. Okay, we can say that with relative certainty. Okay. What are the implications of inefficiently low water prices? You know, again, Marianne talked about this in some ways in the early part of her discussion. In the short run, obviously, right, consumers are using too much water relative to what would be efficient, and water conservation takes place only under what we would, Chuck Howe, a water economist at the University of Colorado Boulder, who's now emeritus, calls sort of moral suasion or direct regulation. Okay, without the prices giving people the signal about how much it's worth, it's very hard to get people, in some cases, to conserve water. In the long run, Marianne showed you a map of where all the population growth is occurring in the United States, and it's shocking, right, that so much is occurring in areas that are very water short. And that's, I should say, not just true in population growth, thinking about the residential sector, but think about, you know, we have oil refining in Texas, a very, very heavy use of water. We have semiconductor manufacturing in California, very, very heavy use of water. In part, we have to blame at least some of those, what we see as sort of perverse patterns in growth, on the fact that in the long run, prices for water, a very important and a very scarce resource in these regions, have been so low, okay? And that the people that are coming there, people that are choosing to install a lawn or a pool, right, or a semiconductor manufacturing facility, are making that decision in some part, right? Not because prices are pretty low right now, in some part on what water prices are and what they expect them to be in the long run. Okay, so a final recommendation, and this is not a sort of full employment policy for water resource economists, but in general, you know, you want to sort of, to the extent that you can, you want to try and apply as much as possible benefit-cost analyses to whatever water conservation policy you're implementing. Like, understand what it is that you've done, keeping very close records of what you've done in terms of price increases or changing the structure of prices or implementing, technology, retrofitting subsidies or other kinds of programs. We want to know, right, how do things compare to each other, what's the effect of those things relative to their costs and so on. And I would say the costs of the non-price policies are often calculated. See estimates out there by the federal government, by local governments and others. And the cost and benefits of price increases are often calculated. The cost side there is very easy, right? It's the cost of the price increase. The benefits is, right, how much water you reduce. But the benefits of non-price policies are less well understood, right? The precise benefits in terms of the water savings that have been achievable. And in this sort of world where we've been implementing these things in a second best setting where we maybe can't increase prices, we're doing our best to educate people about the value of this scarce resource, that's perfectly reasonable, right, that we're implementing them because we know we'll get some water savings and we're trying to get those benefits. But as we have more and more of these programs in place, as water gets more and more scarce, it's going to be much more important to understand precisely what they accomplish and compare those to what we might accomplish through prices.
We probably have time for maybe one question. Do we have one from the crowd?
Well, I guess I would ask you to sort of keep in mind one of the last points I made, right, that the price of gasoline goes up, and surely we can measure the reduction in consumption that results from the increase in the price of gasoline. But A, you have to think that the price of gasoline is low and has been low for a long time, okay? It has driven investments in automobiles and other things, right, that we replace only once every, well, if you're me, once every 15 years, but, you know, other people more frequently. And so, you know, we don't see necessarily on the whole people sort of all of a sudden running to trade in their SUV for a Prius, but we do see people buying more Prius, Prii, And we do see people buying fewer SUVs, and we can show that that's an effect, right? And again, that elasticity, that price sensitivity in the long run is going to be a lot bigger and have a lot bigger bang than what we're going to see in the short run. And you have to keep in mind, right, population is going up, income is going up, all of these things, well, income goes up, right, and down. But at the same time, right, and it's very difficult. You've got to sort of understand that in addition to that effect of price, right, we have the effect of all these other factors that are driving demand up. So you want to be careful and not sort of be too hard on, you know, the sort of price effects of the gasoline price increases. Do you want to say, Tim?
Two quick questions. One is, you talk a lot about incoming block rate structures, and you talk about the cost being very low, but you don't speak specifically about marginal cost prices.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Scarcity or market clearing costs.
Right. Oh, yeah.
And the second thing I would like to be talking about is how do you reconcile, if you're sending an efficient signal to the customer, also having rebates.
Okay, so two things. So first, Tim asked a question about, I've talked about increasing block pricing. What about marginal cost pricing? Now, the ideal from an economic perspective is to charge every unit of water that people consume in a town at the long-run marginal cost, and that includes opportunity costs for reduced environmental flows and everything else. Okay, that's ideally what we would do, is we charge everybody that high price. And then, you know, an economist would say, oh, and then people would say, well, but then the utility is going to make a big profit. Okay, then, and an economist would say, well, then you rebate that to them. And the important thing to keep in mind is it's that signal on the margin that's affecting their behavior. Now, certainly that rebate, the sort of total amount that the utility could take in could be very big. And the question is how to deliver that back to consumers without watering down that signal that we think is so important. And as I mentioned earlier, there are many ways that that can be done, and there's a lot of discussion of this with respect to climate change, right? How would we tax carbon, and then, you know, what do we do with the revenues from those taxes, and how do we make sure that doesn't affect that incentive on the margin to reduce greenhouse gas emissions? And the conversation could be very, very similar for water. And essentially, as long as you do something that is not tied to current consumption, again, that's not going to mess up that signal that they're getting on the margin from their current consumption, there you have a lot of leeway for doing things that will not affect, right, that the relevance and the sort of stringency of that signal that they're getting at when they turn on their tap or their sprinkler. And so things that people have proposed are, you know, means testing, you know maybe sort of a distributional program for low-income households, you know, taking, you know, households that have been particularly water conserving relative to the average, you know, or even some objective measure like, you know, what do they have planted outside, and rewarding consumers like that with the rebate. That's also another good thing to do. And again, it's that increase, that sort of signal on the margin, that price that they pay when they turn on their sprinkler, that's what we really want to affect. And what happens, right, aside from a rebate that is so big that it significantly increases a household's income, into which then we'd think, right, through that other pathway that affects demand, income, that we'd have an effect, we really aren't talking about something that would have a very strong effect on consumers' behavior. But that's a really good question. And I think, you had two questions. Okay. Mm-hmm. Right. Watering restrictions, right? Okay, so that $81 comes in part, in a very small part, from the fact that we're not asking consumers to do one specific thing in their household. We're not saying you have to reduce and you have to reduce from outdoor watering. They could do essentially anything they want. They can, you know, as Marion was joking before, turn off the water when they brush their teeth. They can get their front-loading clothes washer. They can do almost anything they want. So we're not restricting indoors versus outdoors. But that's a very small effect, because if you look out there at the types of uses that consumers would want to reduce in response to a price increase, it tends to be the outdoor uses. Okay, not a big surprise. The big bang that you get comes from this movement across households, okay? So the water flows to the households that have the highest value in use, right, of the resource, which is why we see that it's the low-income households that are very happy to give up white water for outdoors, and the high-income households that are very happy to suck up that water for outdoor use. And so you have to think very carefully about what you do then, right? You're going to increase revenues very substantially. Can we imagine a rebate scheme, right, that sort of sufficiently compensates the households that give up the water for the households that actually take the water, okay? And thinking about whether you'd want to use that money for some income redistribution, for some conservation programming, right, or whatever it happens to be. So that $81 comes from flexibility within a household about where it can cut back consumption, and flexibility across households in terms of who's reducing consumption.